This, I'm Ted Ludwig, and this is the last session in my series of sessions on Christianity and the other world religions. Today the topic is the Muslim pilgrimage and ours. I think you all were here, and you remember that I've been kind of working with the idea of pilgrimage this week. Since it is the week of Muslim pilgrimage, right now Muslims are still gathered in Mecca on the pilgrimage. It was also Pentecost last Sunday, and that's a pilgrimage feast in the Bible when Jews came from all over the world to gather at Jerusalem. So the image of Christians as a pilgrimage people on the way, following Christ, following the Christian vision, but also recognizing that there are fellow pilgrims in this world, including the Jews and the Muslims, which we've talked about particularly this week, also the Native Americans and the other peoples of the world. And so the idea that I've been trying to get across is that if we Christians are serious about helping to create a whole new world today, we need to learn about these other peoples of the world, these fellow pilgrims, and understand them better and hear their stories, share our stories with them. But in that process of dialogue, as we call it, we'll learn new things. We'll learn new things about them, we'll learn new things about us, and perhaps even unheard of things will develop that we can't even imagine at this point in time. Yesterday we talked about the Muslims, this great world religion, which is almost as numerous as Christians in the world. The latest figures that I've seen suggest that there are somewhat over 1 billion Christians in the world, you know, broadly speaking, counting most people in America as Christian. And there are nearly 1 billion Muslims, about 900 million, nearly 1 billion Muslims. So while they perhaps are not quite as numerous as Christians, almost.
Then where would the Buddhists come in?
Oh, it's really hard to say because of the problem of China, the People's Republic, which used to be thoroughly Buddhist, and you know that's a billion people right there. But since the communist takeover has been very much secularized, so maybe a half a billion Buddhists, 500 million, something like that. So last time we tried to look into the basic vision of Islam, particularly by using the creed, right? There is no God but God, which suggests that grand vision of the oneness of God and the oneness of creation, the oneness of the human race, and the role of humans to in a sense, cooperate with God in promoting God's design for the whole world. And then the second part of the creed, focusing on the messengers of God, the Muslim idea that God has always been sending messengers to guide humans. In all human communities that have ever existed, there have been messengers from God. But of course, the final messenger being Muhammad, who brought the final revelation in a modern language that's available to all people, Arabic, right? And thus there doesn't need to be any more messengers. So Muhammad being the final messenger. And the revelation that he brought is the Quran, which lays out the way of life that God wants everyone to follow. Now what I want to do today is to focus especially on the five pillars of Islam. Because in the Quran, these are five basic requirements that are laid down for all Muslims. To live your life fully as a Muslim, it is an obligation to perform these five worships of God, they're called, the five pillars or worships of God. And I think by looking at them a little bit more closely, we can get a kind of a concrete sense of what the Muslim religion is all about. Some people say there are six pillars, and let me start with the sixth pillar, which is not really one of the pillars, but I think will help kind of set the tone for all the pillars for Muslims. That sixth pillar is sometimes the one that is called jihad, which many of you have heard about probably. What do you remember what jihad means?
Holy war.
Holy war, right? And once we hear that word, we back up and say, terrorists, you know. Well, that's, unfortunately, that's the translation that's often used. And sometimes it does mean that. Sometimes it means the obligation of Muslims to go out and engage in warfare against an enemy of God. But the basic meaning of jihad is striving in the cause of God. Striving in the cause of God. And Muslims point out that there is a greater jihad and a lesser jihad. The greater jihad is the striving that we all must do to be Muslims. You know, to root out all of those things in ourselves that keep us from submitting to God. All those selfish things, those erroneous things, those bad things that keep us straying off the path. That's a big battle, right? And that is what jihad is all about, striving in the cause of God. The lesser jihad is that requirement now and then to fight against enemies of God. You know, people who profane God's name or who oppress people or whatever. So I wanted to get that idea out of Islam as a striving on the path. The straight path, Islam is called. The path that God wants you to follow. And the general sense is that we should be filled with zeal and faith and confidence so that we strive in the cause of God always in everything. Now, with that as kind of the introduction, let's look at the five pillars or the five requirements. One of the things that I want to emphasize is how each one of those five pillars provides a rather dramatic experience, both of the oneness of God and of the oneness of humanity. Right? That's what Islam is all about. It's about oneness, tawhid, oneness. And each one of the worships or the pillars is designed to give a concrete experience of that oneness. The oneness of God and the oneness of humanity. Now, of course, the oneness of humanity is an idealized concept because Muslims, like Christians, realize that humanity is not one. Right? There are Jews and Christians and Muslims, and then there are the polytheists, you know, who worship many gods. So actually, humankind is split up. But the Muslim community, or the ummah, represents the oneness of humankind, right? It's kind of a representative community that ideally should include all humanity. At the present moment, it only includes those who actually have submitted to God, who have become Muslims. But ideally, it includes everybody. Okay, the first pillar is saying the confession, or the shahada. We talked about that last time in rather great detail. I confess that there is no God but God. I confess that Muhammad is the messenger of God. That's the confession. And that's an obligation for Muslims to say that. Saying that, as I mentioned last time, is what makes you a Muslim. Saying it with intent in your heart. All of the pillars require, first of all, the intention, right? The intention to perform the pillar. So the intention means really believing in the one God and then confessing it. Really believing in Muhammad as the messenger and the Quran as the revelation of God and then confessing it. So many times every day, Muslims repeat that creed. I testify that there is no God but God. I testify that Muhammad is his messenger. It's the first thing a baby hears when a baby is born. It's the last thing a dying person hears when she dies. It's incorporated in every prayer, in every call to prayer, in every devotion, in every reading of the scriptures. It's just a kind of a constant
sound that's going on throughout the world. Remember, Muslims live all over the world, and somewhere in the world, constantly, someone is saying the Shahada. Right? It never stops. And so it kind of symbolizes the oneness of humankind. But it also is a vertical reality. Muslims talk about the confession as a crossroads, you know, of the vertical, which reaches to God, and the horizontal, which reaches out to all other people. Right? So it's quite a conception of oneness. Oneness with God and oneness with all other people, simply by repeating the confession over and over again. Okay? Now, we talked about the meaning of that last time, so we don't need to go into it today. You know, the one God idea and Muhammad is the prophet idea. So let's move on to the second pillar, which is the pillar of prayer, or salat. Now, I know that many of you know something about Islam, so what are the central aspects of the pillar of prayer?
Going towards Mecca.
Okay, facing Mecca, first of all. I suppose first we should say intention, right? Okay. And the intention begins when you hear the call for prayer coming, right? Five times a day, prayer is an obligation. And to signal the time for prayer, the muezzin calls out the call to prayer, the adnan, the call for prayer from the minarets, right? If you're in a Muslim village or a Muslim city, you hear that, just, you know, wafting through the air. It's a very beautiful chant. You know, there is no God but God, Muhammad is his messenger, God is the greatest, Allahu Akbar, come to prayer, come to prayer, come to salvation, come to salvation, and, you know, it's repeated several times. And then people stop what they are doing and, you know, intend to perform the prayer. So first is the intention. Second, then, is purification, purifying yourself. With water, right? Washing your hands and your arms and your ears and your hair and your mouth and your nostrils and your feet and so forth. Then you prepare a place for yourself. It might be a prayer rug or just a clean spot somewhere. You face Mecca, as you say. And then you perform the very physical act of prayer, which involves all kinds of bodily engagement. You know, first you stand, and then you bow your hands on your knees, and then you put your forehead down on the ground, and then you sit back up, and, you know, you say, peace be upon you, and peace be upon you, to, you know, to all other people. And then you perform it again several times, depending on which prayer it is. In the early morning prayer at first dawn, you do that, I think, four times. In the mid-afternoon prayer, you only do it twice, I believe. So, you know, it differs depending upon which prayer it is. The content of the prayer is really pretty standard. It's in Arabic. It's usually simply verses from the Quran. It's not the kind of prayer that we think of as sort of coming from the heart and extemporaneous, asking for things that you need. It's rather an act of praise, right? An act of praise of God. And since it involves standard words and verses, prayers all over the world are basically the same. So people praying in India and in Canada and in Saudi Arabia and in South Africa, they're all saying the same words all over the world. And they're all facing that center of the world. You know, there's a big concentric circle all around the world, and everybody is facing the center of the world, and they're all bowing, performing the same physical actions, and they're saying the same words.
It's a prayer to God, not to Muhammad.
Oh, it's a prayer to God. Oh, no, not to Muhammad. No,
Muhammad
is not a God. Muhammad is a man, the great prophet, but he died.
It's different than Christian religion, right? Where we play, okay.
Right. I've got just a couple of slides of prayer that we can look at while we're talking about it a little bit more. That way I don't have to perform it for you. You can see Muslims performing it. Well, first of all, this is the Shahada written in Arabic in these flowing Arabic letters. And this is
there is no God but God. And then this, in a circle right over here, is Muhammad is the messenger of God, written in a circle. So that's the confession right there on the wall for you.
Is that more script inside the large script, or is that?
Yes, that's a verse from the Quran, verses from the Quran written inside of here, right? That's the way Muslims decorate, by using this beautiful Arab calligraphy, and particularly using verses from the Quran. You know, this is all over the mosques. Like, this is a beautiful mosque in Iraq, and the Shahada is actually written in square letters and circles up here. Okay? So it's just all around you. And these are verses from the Quran here. And then, of course, there is the Quran in a medieval manuscript, a very sacred book. Muslims will not even pick up a Quran without first purifying themselves of water. So I always have to be a little bit careful with classes if I want to show people the Quran. You don't treat it lightly. In some ways, I shouldn't even be touching it since I'm not actually Muslim. But I use it for teaching purposes. So that's the holy book. Then the ritual of prayer, as I mentioned, first of all, purification of yourself with water. Then preparing a place. He has a prayer rug. If there are other Muslims, you line up in a line, and one Muslim will stand in front as the prayer leader.
By the way,
proper dress. The woman's dress here?
This one and the previous one, if I just saw that, I would think maybe that's a Hindu dress.
Yeah,
what's the difference? Possibly. Is there any standard difference?
There's no standard dress for Muslims. Any dress will do. This happens to be a kind of a preferred dress in the Middle East. This is in Indonesia. I'm sorry. This is in Indonesia, and it's kind of what they prefer there. It's hot. They like light clothing. It is proper to cover your head, although it's not necessary, particularly for men. Women are expected to cover their hair in traditional Islam. So here in Indonesia would be a complete woman's attire. It's not necessary to cover all like that, but this is sort of a proper way to do it. Then the part of the prayer begins with the hands held up, with certain verses spoken. Hands on the knees with some more verses. Prostration, which is submission to God, right? This is a very concrete way of submitting to God. You got your forehead down on the ground, you can't really feel very proud, right? You're really submitting yourself physically, in a sense. And woman here.
Now, do they make sure of what direction they're bowing in?
Oh, yes, definitely. So you face the direction of Mecca.
Mecca, and that is, I'm sorry, is it east, west?
Well, it depends where you are in the world. Some Muslims that I know have a little prayer compass, which you can set to the city nearest you. Like here we would set it at Seattle, right? And then the needle would point in the direction, or somehow or other, would be set up so it would show the direction to Mecca, based upon where the North Pole is from here, where Seattle is, and where Mecca is from here. I don't even know for sure which direction it would be, since it's way on the other side of the world. Uh-huh. But I'm sure Muslims in this area know what direction.
Check that out very carefully.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some of them, I've seen them built into their watches as well.
Yeah, right.
And they'll also tell them the times of prayer.
That's right.
And the watch will point in the direction of prayer. Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's very important, because Mecca is the center of the world. And the symbolism is that the whole human community all around the world are all facing the same center. It's the oneness idea that is really symbolized. And you're saying the same words. Moreover, since there are time changes throughout the world, it's if you use your imagination a little bit, you could say that there are people doing the prayer always. Right now it's about noontime, so it's time for our noontime prayers here. So we'll be saying them, but somewhere else they're already saying the evening prayers, and in another hour over in the next time zone they'll start the morning prayers, and so it's a sense that the prayers are going on constantly all around the world, all facing the same center, praying to the one God. Quite an experience. And for Muslims, the prayer is really the kind of the ultimate symbol of being a Muslim. Right? That's the concrete thing that you do every day, five times a day. There's no vacation from it. You don't get a day off. It really sacralizes your whole time. You can't forget about God, right? If you're doing this five times a day, every day, all the days of your life. Now, of course, if you're sick, if you're having a baby, if you're, you know, off on a trip somewhere, there are ways of compensating for it. A bunch of boys in the school in Indonesia, the young women are behind the young men. That's typically the way they do it. They don't put the women in front, partly because of the posture and so forth. They put the men in the front and the women behind. And then after the prostration, the sitting back and saying some more prayers, and including the peace be to you to all other fellow human beings to both sides.
What if there's no one right next to you?
You still do it because they're always, this is fellow humanity, right? So that's some shots of the...
Do they do it at different speeds, obviously?
But generally, it's supposed to be a leisurely prayer. I mean, you don't rush through it because it's a time of great spiritual meditation and, feeling of oneness with God, feeling of oneness with everyone else. It's not something you rush, right?
So how long a time would you say?
Well, it takes about 5 minutes, typically.
But it can be...
10 minutes, maybe, in the more extensive prayers.
But it can be repetitive.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It is repetitive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's nothing new.
It's praising God. Mm-hmm. Now, they do also, of course, Muslims also have what they call private prayer, dua, which is the prayer of the heart. You know, and you do that anytime. You're in trouble, you call out, help me God, or something great happens and you say praise be to God, or you say prayers in your heart. But that's not what this is. This is an obligation of publicly witnessing and praising God in a very physical fashion together with all other Muslims. Then the third.
I have one more question.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Do they have anything like in Christianity where we say before you would go to the altar, if you have anything against a brother, you must take care of that first?
Yeah, they would say that, but if you can't get that straight, then you're not a Muslim any longer. In other words, this is an obligation. Mm-hmm. When it's noontime, you say your prayers, and you better get all these things straight. So it's not quite the same then as in Christianity. It's an obligation. If you're not doing it, that means that you are not a faithful Muslim. Okay, then the next pillar, let's say, will be zakat, or almsgiving. Actually, Muslims nowadays prefer to call this wealth sharing, simply because the idea of giving alms has gotten kind of a bad connotation in Western society. These poor people living in the streets will toss them a few coins, and that's like alms, right? Alms for the poor. Really, the pillar of sharing your wealth is an expression of the unity of the whole community, right? Now, in Islam, there's nothing bad about being wealthy. In fact, if you are a good Muslim, and if you really live according to God's design, you probably will have a prosperous life, right? If you actually live the way God wants you to live, everything will be in harmony, and you will become wealthy and prosperous. And there's nothing wrong with that. But what this pillar does is to remind people that all of this wealth comes from God, and it is to be shared. It's not to be hoarded. Hoarding is contrary to the whole spirit of Islam. So the idea is that it is an obligation on all Muslims to share their wealth with those who, for various reasons, are less fortunate. Usually that amounts to about 2.5% of your total worth during the year. Cash and cattle and crops is the way they put it. CCC, cash, cattle, and crops, which basically means everything. It does, in modern times, it gets rather complicated because, you may own
a company, but you've got a a huge liability, and so you don't really have anything extra and so forth. But basically, 2.5% of your total worth during the year is what you should share with the poorer people. And there are various mechanisms for doing that. But most of all, it is done in a spirit of sharing, not in a spirit of condensation or charity or making the other person feel less valuable or whatever. It is strictly sharing between brothers and sisters. And there's no sense of one is better than the other. It's a matter of this wealth is God's and we share it equally. Out of this notion of sharing also comes some basic economic principles for Muslims. We might just mention the prohibition of usury as part of this whole notion of wealth. You know what usury is?
Charging interest.
Charging interest. That's against the Muslim law. To lend somebody money and then say, now I want my money back and I want some extra besides. That's no. Because you're taking advantage of another person. The other person needs money, you loan some money to that person, and then you take advantage of it for your own benefit. That's out. Makes banking a little difficult and so forth. And there are ways that Muslims have of doing that, particularly what nowadays they're calling profit sharing. You loan money to someone. Now, you don't ask interest for it. But when they use that money and begin to make a profit with it, then they share some of the profit with you, right? So it's again a sense of sharing rather than extracting money no matter what, right? So that's again this principle of wealth sharing. Okay, then the next pillar is fasting. The fast. And this is something that's very specific and clear. It is performed during the month of Ramadan, which is one of the months of the Muslim year. Right now we're in the pilgrimage month, but a few months ago it was the month of Ramadan, and that's the month of fasting. I think it happened about in March this year. It changes year to year because the Muslim year is about 13 days shorter than the solar calendar that we operate on, so gradually it comes a little bit earlier every year. I remember about 10 years ago I was living in Jordan for the summer doing some archaeology, and the fast came right in the middle of July, and it's hot as blazes. In Jordan, out in the desert, down by the Dead Sea in July, but the Muslims kept the fast. Basically, the fast requires that during daylight hours, from the time in the morning when you can distinguish a white thread from a black thread by natural light, until sundown in the evening, you don't take anything into your body. No water, no food, no medicine, no smoking, no sex, and so on. Now, during the night time, of course, that is relaxed. You eat and drink during the night. But during the day, you fast. In fact, to make sure that you know when daylight begins, a cannon goes off. I remember every morning being awakened at 2:30, boom! This cannon, it still looked perfectly dark outside to me, but some Muslim imam was able to say, now the light is beginning, so it's time to start fasting. Actually, they had a cannon that went off a little bit before daylight, so Muslims could wake up and perform their prayers and eat and drink a little bit, and then begin the fast. But the fast then lasted until, 8 o'clock at night. So from maybe 4 in the morning till 8 o'clock at night, they didn't eat or drink, and they worked out in the hot sun. I just couldn't understand how they could do it. But the whole idea of Ramadan and the fast is not to punish yourself. That's not at all the idea in Islam. It's not that our body is bad and we need to starve ourselves and punish ourselves. Rather, the whole notion of the fast is simply another way of expressing submission to God and solidarity with your other humans. Because all Muslims fast together, the whole community fasts. Restaurants are closed. there are extra... set up. People gather together to study the Quran at night. It's a time of intense praying and spiritual renewal, right? So it's a time of rededication to God, not a time of punishing yourself through fasting. Muslims also say that it helps you to feel solidarity with the poor, with those who don't have any food throughout the world. And besides, it's good for you to fast. You know, there's something refreshing about abstaining from food and drink for a while, so that you know, your body can kind of flush itself out and be renewed.
How many days in a row?
About 28. It's a lunar month. 28 or 29 days they perform the fast, and then it ends with a great feast. One of the two great festivals throughout the year, the feast of fast breaking, which is a very joyful time in the community. You know, that's when they get together and have banquets and plays and so forth. So this is a very special time in Muslim communities. Of course, it's very difficult for Muslims in America to keep the fast. Many of them try. I know at my university, we happen to have quite a large number of Muslims, probably about 40 or 50 of them, from both from the Middle East and from Indonesia and Malaysia and so forth. And many of them do fast. And I think it's very important for the rest of us to be aware of that and sensitive to it. A couple of years ago, the fast fell right during final examination time. You know, if I hadn't known about it, I might have expected, you know, things of these students that they weren't able to do because, you know, they're fasting. They say that the first few days of the fast are the most difficult, but then after, you know, 3 or 4 days, it gets rather easy. So maybe we should try it sometime. And then finally, the theme of unity is a very important one here. Everyone does it. The whole community does it together as something in common, supporting one another. And they're doing it because it is one of the laws given by God, as a remembrance of God, as a testimony to God. And then finally, the Hajj, or the pilgrimage to Mecca. The Hajj is an obligation for all Muslims once at least in their lifetime. Some Muslims do it many times, particularly if they are able to. But at least once in your lifetime, you should save up your money and make your plans and make that long trip to Mecca to perform the pilgrimage, which basically amounts to sort of retracing the steps of the Prophet Muhammad. Shortly before Muhammad died, he made a pilgrimage to Mecca. At that time, he was living in Medina, which is up here about 200 miles north of Mecca, where he had founded Islam. But he made a pilgrimage to the holy place in Mecca, the Kaaba, and performed all of these rituals, sort of setting the model then for all Muslims after that, once in their lifetime, to come to the center of the world, right? They've been praying toward in the direction of this center all of their lives. Now, once in their lifetime, they're supposed to journey there, make that pilgrimage, and be at the center of the world, and say their prayers there. So it's kind of the climaxing experience of a Muslim's life to go on that pilgrimage.
Is it holy because he was born there, or because of revelation of the Quran?
No, neither.
Neither? Huh.
It's holy because God built that house, or God had Adam and Eve build that house as the central temple or house of God in the world. It was destroyed in the flood. And therefore God told Abraham and his son Ishmael, remember, the oldest son of Abraham, to journey to Mecca and rebuild the Kaaba, it's called that. The Kaaba. It is basically just a big stone structure there in Mecca. And according to Muslims, it's been there, you know, ever since the time of Abraham. It is symbolic of God's central presence in the world, although, of course, God isn't there. It's empty, right? Before the time of Muhammad, it was there, but they had filled it with 360 statues of gods and goddesses. One of the first things Muhammad did when Mecca surrendered to him was to go to the Kaaba and clean it out. And then he proclaimed, from this time on, this is the holy place, Mecca, and the Kaaba. No non-Muslim will ever set foot here. In other words, in order to come here, you must be a Muslim. And that's still true today. When you're driving on the highway toward Mecca, it's a super highway now, and as you're approaching Mecca, there's a big sign up there and a turn off, and it says non-Muslims, and there's a big arrow, right? You go this way, so you don't go into Mecca. To go to Mecca, of course, you need a special visa issued by the Saudi government, and you have, you know, you are Muslim. Non-Muslims simply don't go there.
So how big of an area is it?
It's a kind of an oblong area. It includes the old city of Mecca and then a rather large section of the desert, Mina and the plain of Arafat, probably about 20 kilometers long altogether and not quite that wide. So that's called the holy place, the Haram. And that's where the rituals of the pilgrimage take place. I've got a few slides that I'll show you of the pilgrimage, but maybe just a couple of other things first. While this is an obligation for all Muslims, it's very clear in Islamic law that that you must prepare yourself for it. You know, the idea of intention, right? Intention to go on the pilgrimage. You're not supposed to make the pilgrimage, for example, if you have to borrow money to do it. That puts you in debt. You shouldn't go on the pilgrimage if you're in debt. Or if you have to take food away from your children in order to go on the trip. Or if you're sick and, you know, you can't stand up to the trip or, you know, so forth. So it takes very careful planning and intention. But hopefully one day, sometime in your lifetime, you will be able to make that pilgrimage and thus fulfill your obligation and become a Hajji, or one who has done the pilgrimage, right? That's a term of great respect. A Hajji is someone who has fulfilled that obligation of making the pilgrimage. Okay, let me show you a few pictures and make some comments as we're going along.
So the poorer people would really have much more of a difficult time of going mm-hmm. to Mecca then and mm-hmm. probably not being able to access that as readily as someone else could want.
That's right. And that's why wealth sharing is important, right?
Yeah.
And also making it possible in various ways for pilgrims to make that trip, since the Saudi government has gotten so rich, they basically finance many of the pilgrims stay in Saudi Arabia. You know, so once they get there, it's rather reasonable for pilgrims. Of course, the getting there is still a major expense. People come by boat. People even walk, you know, across North Africa to get over to Mecca and so forth.
This wealth share, do they only give alms to the Muslims?
Yes, you only give zakat to Muslims.
You don't give to non-Muslims.
You help non-Muslims in various ways, giving them money, food, whatever is needed, but it's not zakat. See, this is a religious obligation to God.
But didn't God say that there's equality between all human beings?
Yes, but the fulfilling the obligation means sharing your wealth with fellow Muslims. Now, it is also an obligation for Muslims to help the poor, no matter who they are. But that is not the pillar of zakat. That's another thing that you should do. Right? Mm-hmm.
What time frame are we looking at for this massive amount of people to go through there? I mean, I've seen pictures in National Geographic of just swarms going through.
Right. There's actually two pilgrimages. There's the lesser pilgrimage, or Umrah, which you can do anytime. Anytime you have an opportunity to visit Mecca, you can do the lesser pilgrimage. Which is basically the first part of the larger pilgrimage. It's visiting Mecca and visiting the Kaaba and so forth. No, that doesn't fulfill the obligation. But you can do that anytime. To fulfill the obligation of pilgrimage, you must do it during pilgrimage month, which is right now, and you must do it within a certain time frame, and together with all other Muslims. So this is when you have up to 3 million Muslims coming together at once in Mecca, which is actually, you know, not a big town, the old city of Mecca. And, you know, there's a lot of people.
So when they're going in then for this time, I don't know too much about other religions, so everyone's going to have to forgive me here.
No, well,
but
do they
lay themselves prostrate and do a full length of their body? Is this the religion that does that?
Well, I showed you a picture of the prayer there where...
how do I say this? There is a religion in the world that lays their body down, prostrate, flat, and literally crawls or whatever it is to the shrine.
No, that's not Muslim.
That's not Muslim.
Maybe some disciplines in Hinduism or some. Islam. The prayer is the prostration with your forehead on the ground, and the other postures. It is, you know, it's not groveling. That's not what it is.
Yeah.
It is an adult human being created by God as kind of a partner with God in creation, showing that God is the master. but here are pilgrims arriving in Jeddah on the coast to perform the pilgrimage. And nowadays most people come by airplane or by boat and wind up at the port of Jeddah, where they receive special visas from the government and don their pilgrimage clothing, which for men is basically a two-piece garment, two white pieces, one around the shoulders, one around the waist. For women, it can be anything, but typically it will take the form of a white garment also covering the hair. That means entering into a special consecrated state. You know, profess your intention to perform the pilgrimage. You put on the garment, you take certain vows like no sexual contact, no harming of any living thing, no cutting of your hair, and a few other things, just to symbolize this as a special time, a time of pilgrimage, right? It's not like ordinary time, it's a sacred time set aside. So they begin that already when they arrive in Jeddah, most of them, and then they make this trip of about 40 miles by bus, or used to make it by camel, some of them still do, or walking, to Mecca. And finally, the arriving pilgrim sees that which she has been facing all of her life, right? In saying her prayers, they may have pictures on the wall or something. They've been facing in the direction of the Kaaba, but now, finally, you see it. It's actually this little building in the center of this open-air mosque. This is a great open-air mosque built to accommodate lots of people, but not big enough, because when everyone is there, the whole inside is filled, and all the area around the outside is also filled with people. But at least it's a tremendous experience for pilgrims to first arrive here, to see the Kaaba now. This is the cube-like structure, which I mentioned was actually built by Abraham and Ishmael. Thus it goes way back to, you know, the ancestors. As God's house, the center of the world.
You don't have to go around like 7 times?
Right, that's one of the rituals. But first we're just getting there.
Yeah.
And of course one of the first things that pilgrims will want to do when they get there is to say their prayers. Right? So now here they're in a great... in great concentric circles all around the Kaaba, you know, starting in the center and moving out and not stopping in Mecca, but going, you know, to all the rest of the world, saying the noon prayer. I mean, you know, it must be a tremendous experience. You've been doing this all of your life from North America. Now you're right there and saying your prayers. So it's a peak spiritual experience for many Muslims. The building is empty, incidentally, so you don't go inside. That's not the point. They do open it and wash it out during the pilgrimage month.
Are they allowed to touch it?
Oh yeah, they do touch it. And some of them stand by the open doorway so that when they're sweeping the water out, you know, the water falls on them and it does some spiritual cleansing or something. And it is the king and the royal family of Saudi Arabia who go inside. You know, it's tied up with the government, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But anyway.
It looks like there's some kind of a drape or something.
Yes, it is covered with a covering that's changed every year during the pilgrimage month. It's woven covering, decorated with verses of the Quran all around it. That's just the standard covering of the Kaaba.
Is that segregated as well, men and women?
No. Men and women participate together, and children. Right, there's no segregation. but this is at being at the center of the world and also making contact with Abraham and Ishmael and with the Prophet Muhammad and with God. Right? So the first ritual of the pilgrimage then is the circling, as you mentioned. Circling in a counterclockwise direction 7 times, starting off by touching one of the famous stones, the black stone, which supposedly the angel Gabriel brought from heaven and gave to Abraham so that he could build it into the Kaaba. So you first touch it, or, you know, obviously people way over in this corner can only reach their hands out in that direction. And they go around 7 times, saying the prayers of the pilgrimage. Then the next ritual is after that's completed, and that can be done on different days. It doesn't all have to be done just on one day. Then the next ritual is the running, where they run back and forth between 2 mountains. Since it's so hot in Mecca, nowadays they've built a walkway that's covered to protect them from the sun. But they're running back and forth 7 times. What this symbolizes a story in the Quran about Abraham, and particularly about Hagar and Ishmael. Remember, Hagar was given to Abraham as his second wife because Sarah was barren, and she had Ishmael as her first son. Ishmael is the ancestor of the Meccans. But Abraham took them down to the desert here because Sarah insisted on it and left them there, and they were dying of thirst. So Hagar ran frantically back and forth looking for water. And then the angel Gabriel provided a spring, a well that sprang up from the sand, the well of Zamzam. So what these people are doing is remembering and repeating the running of Hagar looking for water. And then when they're finished, I don't have a picture here, but then they take a drink from the well of Zamzam. You know, it's just kind of an interesting thought. Now that's the first part of the pilgrimage, and that's the part you can do any time. But of course, pilgrims do it during the month of pilgrimage because the obligation is on the 9th day of pilgrimage month to be out in the plain of Arafat. So the whole 3 million Muslims moves out to the desert, and they set up tents. You know, there's like a great tent city grows up out there. You know, 3 million people—that's a lot of people. And they spend about the next 4 or 5 days out here in the desert performing rituals. The climax comes on the 9th day when at noon, from noon till sunset, all Muslims gather together on the Mountain of Mercy and in the Plain of Arafat, praying to the one God. Now, this is all 3 million Muslims who have come from every corner of the earth, gathering together as one community, praying to the one God. And, you know, Muslims say that's the high point. You know, it's highly symbolic. This is the mountain from which Muhammad gave his farewell address. This is the mountain where God brought Adam and Eve together after they had been kicked out of the Garden of Eden. They lost each other and wandered around the earth. And God, in his mercy, brought them together here on this mountain. So this is where the human race came, right? And this is also where Judgment Day will take place. So it's, you know, it's highly symbolic, this standing on Mount Arafat. I think I mentioned earlier in the week, this took place last Sunday on the day of Pentecost. It was also the day of the standing for Muslims.
Is Mount Arafat also not allowed, you can't go there unless you're Muslim?
Right, this is all the sacred territory. This is exclusively for Muslims. Okay, so this is the high point, and some photos that would illustrate that. the spiritual devotion and intensity of feeling and so forth. Then some other rituals take place. There's a ritual of stoning. Muslims gather 49 stones and throw them at three pillars, which are called the Satans. This goes back to a story of Abraham and Ishmael, similar to the Hebrew Bible. God commanded Abraham to sacrifice Ishmael. He took Ishmael down here to Mina and prepared to sacrifice him. The devil came and tried to tempt Ishmael to run away. And Ishmael picked up some rocks and threw them at the devil. Then, of course, when Abraham prepared to sacrifice him, God kept the knife from striking Ishmael and provided a ram instead. So on the next day comes the Feast of Sacrifice, which happens to be today. Today is the Feast of Sacrifice for Muslims. So in Mecca, they are sacrificing a lamb or a goat or something and then sharing that, particularly with the poorer people. Here's an American woman on pilgrimage at the feast. But this is also a feast that Muslims throughout the world are celebrating. So this is in Denver. They also have sacrificed a lamb and are sharing in the feast. So that's one thing that links this whole world together with those who are at Mecca.
So do they personally have to sacrifice something?
Someone in the family. Mm-hmm. Of course, you don't want too many animals sacrificed, so there's a sense of kind of sharing it so that you don't have a surplus. And if there's too much, then maybe you can make it into a money donation to poor people so that you don't have all kinds of food left over. But the symbolism is a sacrifice. Remembering Abraham's sacrifice. Right?
So you mean they have to take a live animal and kill it themselves?
Someone does. I mean, it doesn't have to be each individual, but representatives. Just to represent Abraham's sacrifice.
So
this, incidentally, is a religious freedom issue in America right now. Certain states would like to pass laws forbidding people from sacrificing animals. What about the Muslim feast that's taking place today, which requires them to sacrifice?
I recall.
Next week, Ed Gaffney will be here, dean of our law school at Valparaiso University, and he is one who is arguing the case before the Supreme Court about religious freedom, specifically about animal sacrifice. So maybe he can tell you all about some of these issues.
I know that they do it also for welcoming people into their community. They'll sacrifice.
Oh yeah, that's hospitality. But this is part of the obligation of the pilgrimage. Well, once this sacrifice is done, then you can cut your hair, which kind of symbolizes that you've fulfilled the obligation. People go back to Mecca, perform the circling of the Kaaba once more, and then they're done. While they're in the vicinity, many of them also visit Medina, the holy city of the Prophet. And if they can, they would like to go to Jerusalem, which is the third holy city, because it is from the Dome of the Rock, where a mosque now stands, that Muhammad made a journey into heaven. That wasn't when he died, but during his lifetime, he was transported to Jerusalem, talked with Jesus and the prophets, and made a journey to heaven before returning again. So this is a very sacred place for Muslims. Unfortunately, it's in Jerusalem, and it's very difficult for Muslims from outside to be able to visit this holy place. Any questions? We've used up most of our time here just running through these pillars, but I hope you at least got some sense of what Islam is all about in the process.
Two quick ones. One is when the lamb is slaughtered, does each small individual do it, or do they have a professional that goes around to kill
it? The individuals are supposed to do it. Okay. I showed you that one slide with people. The lamb is laid down with the head facing Mecca. There's respect for the animal in the prayer position, let's say, and the neck is slit so that all the blood drains out properly. It's done with great respect, people slaughter animals all the time for food. Here's a case of slaughtering an animal as a religious ritual and then using it for food.
The second question relates to, I guess, maybe there's been publicity, about professional athletes that have turned to the Muslim faith.
Right.
Uh-huh. Why, and is that unusual, or is that just because we hear about it more?
Well, I think that's because it is
it has been found by a lot of American blacks who have grown up in a very rough situation and gotten into drugs and gangs and all of that. Some of them have found a kind of spiritual rejuvenation through Islam. You know, that's the black Muslim movement in America. And it has really helped a lot of those people. It's brought them out of this terrible situation and put them back on the straight and narrow. And so, yeah, there's some athletes like Kareem Jabbar and others who have followed that path.
Muhammad Ali was one
in a little bit earlier times. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I had some questions about oral testaments, mm-hmm. what they use and what they don't. My first question was going to be, like, I just had recently read the story of Hagar and Abraham,
mm-hmm.
and I remember hearing that Hagar chose a wife from Egypt for her son.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, well, isn't that quite a ways from Mecca? Does that fit at all with our mm-hmm. Old Testament? But then the idea, I hadn't heard that they say that Ishmael was supposed to be sacrificed rather than Isaac.
Mm-hmm.
So have they just changed that, or have they changed
Yeah, they, in some cases, they feel that the biblical story in the Hebrew Bible probably has been tampered with and changed. In other cases, they might say, well, you know, God did it twice. Once maybe God tested Abraham with respect to his firstborn son, Ishmael, and then maybe he tested him again with respect to his second son, Isaac, who is the ancestor of the Jews, right? Generally, they highly respect the Bible, the Old Testament, but there also is that sense that the Hebrew Bible was written down many, many years after the revelation was given, you know, and therefore mistakes were made, people forgot the real story, and, you know, changes crept in. So it's not accurate. While they have high respect for it, they also say it's incomplete and inaccurate, and finally you have to look to the Quran as the perfect final revelation. And the Quran talks about Abraham and Ishmael, so you know, that's the real story. And whether it happened another time or not, they're not too concerned about.
So do they have strict guidelines, such as our Ten Commandments,
mm-hmm.
and do they really follow that very closely?
Very, very complete guidelines. Last time we talked a little bit about Muslim law, the Sharia, which is drawn from the Quran, and basically covers all of life. You know, from things like not drinking alcohol, that's prohibited, to being, you know, having the obligation of pilgrimage and so forth, and certain duties with respect to marriage, and not lending money on interest, and, you know, certain kinds of government. There's lots and lots of obligations and commandments. Some are absolute, some are highly recommended, right? So it kind of covers all of life, with some flexibility, but certain things are just yes and no, you know, like extramarital sex, or drinking alcohol, or stealing, you know.
How about a value system as far as their education goes? About, you know, Donnie, I've had a fair number of Muslim students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As far as, you know, treating to get ahead and
that, I mean, I'm not saying that some don't do it. You know, there are bad Muslims like there are bad Christians. Christians aren't supposed to cheat either. But generally, I find Muslims to be very, very honest. And most of the Muslims that I've had contact with as students have been rather good Muslims. I mean, they do attempt to live the Muslim life. It's hard in America. You know, they're not supposed to drink. Well, how can you be an undergraduate student in a college when everybody else is drinking beer around you and, you know, and not drink? So, but still, they attempt to carry through on it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, we never really mentioned the relationship between Christians and Muslims. And I was thinking about, like, during the centuries, like, their attitude was not the same as Christian attitude toward other religion. Did they have some kind of religious tolerance? They didn't really believe that. Like the Christian believed that salvation was only within the church.
Well, of course, yeah, right. Muslims, of course, feel that Islam is the final perfect religion for everybody, and everyone should become Muslim. But they make a distinction between the people of the book, that would be Jews and Christians, and actually Zoroastrians also, who believe in the one God,
and thus, in a way, are still kind of people of God, right? Even though they're not Muslims, they're still tolerated, let's say. And polytheists, which would be basically the other religions of the world, tribal religions, even a religion like Hinduism, which with all of these gods would generally, and that's hard to say because Muslims and Hindus have lived together too, but generally polytheists are not allowed. They either are excluded from the community or they convert to Islam, right?